Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, why senior leaders in the George W. Bush administration were divided over whether the 2007 troop surge would help or hurt the U.S. campaign in Iraq, and how the president arrived at the decision to go forward. We'll spend this hour with two editors of a new book made up of oral history interviews with key actors in the White House, Department of Defense, and State Department. The project's goal was to understand the process by which Bush arrived at a critical decision at a stressful time, and how he brought those with dissenting opinions on board once he'd made the call. Our conversation starts after a short break. The stakes gamble of President George W. Bush's 8 years in office was not the decision to begin the Iraq War. It was the decision to double down. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. In late 2006, the U.S. effort in Iraq was at a crisis point. Progress toward democratic governance had failed to yield the kind of stability many leaders had expected, and ongoing Sunni-Shia tensions had brought Iraq to the brink of civil war. U.S. troops were fighting Sunni forces in Fallujah and Shia forces in other parts of the country. Among the options presented to President Bush by advisors, shift the counterinsurgency strategy and augment the U.S. presence in Iraq by some 30,000 troops. Many of us will recall that's what happened, but it wasn't necessarily the obvious choice. In fact, some of Bush's top advisors worried the so-called troop surge could turn out to be a colossal mistake. So what was Mr. Bush's process for making the decision, and what did it take for him to get others on board? William Bowden is executive director and William Powers Jr. Chair at the Clement Center for National Security and associate professor of public affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Jeffrey A. Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Together with Timothy Andrews Sale and Hal Brands, they are editors of the new book, The Last Card, Inside George W. Bush's Decision to Surge in Iraq. Will and Jeffrey, welcome to Think.
Good to see you again.
Great to be here.
So will you start by explaining what was included in this project? Because you gathered oral histories, but there are also a lot of analyses in the book by experts who didn't play a direct role in the decision-making about the surge.
Sure. One of the questions that we had was not necessarily how did the surge succeed or fail, or why was the United States in Iraq, but rather how did this massive fundamental change in policy, as you just described, occur within the upper administration, within the White House? And we knew, interestingly enough, that there were, you know, maybe 500 people in Washington who would tell you that they were the originator of the idea of the surge. Obviously, either that can't be true or it's all going on simultaneously. So we decided to get together as many of the top policymakers as possible from President Bush on down, and simply ask them to tell their stories of how they remember the surge being formed, how they remember the surge ultimately being worked through the policy process in Washington, and actually the most difficult part, how they remember President Bush essentially gaining and persuading people within his own government to do this policy that he wanted to do. We had about 30 people who we interviewed, and we condensed down some of their thoughts into this book in a narrative form so people can read essentially a history of the surge decision. We also decided to include some scholars from outside who would come in and give their critiques of the entire interviews. Obviously, we didn't have enough pages in the universe to publish a book with all the transcripts, all the words of the interviews. So we decided instead to put that up online. So people can read this book, they can see what some scholars thought about the process that unfolded, and then they can actually go and watch the video of people describing this in real time with the transcript to have a better sense of what they think was going on behind the scenes.
So what's the idea, Will, of how students historians will ultimately use these documents?
Well, I do think that we did these interviews, these oral history interviews, in a really unique moment because we did them all 7, 8, 9 years after the fact of the decision itself. We hope that we are hitting the sweet spot there, that it was still recent enough that people's memories are relatively vivid and fresh, but at the same time was distant enough from the surge and the that particular episode in the Iraq War – that they could look back somewhat dispassionately with a little bit more objectivity than you necessarily have when you're in the midst of the crucible there. And as Jeff mentioned earlier, in the book itself, we publish an edited transcript of the those interviews, and we hope that that's an interesting reconstruction of the decision for our readers. But putting all the raw transcripts themselves up online, we think that there are dozens of dissertations to be written on this, maybe other books as well. We hope those can be great resources for other scholars. And then also we are able to get some documents declassified too, which are a supplement to this, and those are online as well. But again, the bulk of it is are these interview transcripts.
One person who wouldn't talk to you was Donald Rumsfeld, who, was ousted before the surge was put in place, but was there through much of the debate and discussion. What sort of an omission is that, and what does that teach you about working with primary sources but not having one primary source available to you?
You know, that's actually something that has bothered me from the very beginning, because Donald Rumsfeld ultimately winds up being, in many ways, I wouldn't say the protagonist of the story, but certainly one of the central characters, largely because he was opposed to the surge. And largely because he was a tectonic figure within – a gigantic figure within Washington policymaking circles. Basically, everything that happened in the surge went through him in some form or fashion, and he simply was not interested in talking. In fact, I should be more specific. We did offer innumerable number of invitations. We actually had confirmed dates for talks several times. I had bought plane tickets for my team several times, and then unfortunately Secretary Rumsfeld canceled. So he is clearly an omission. Because so many of the people in the story talk about Rumsfeld as being key. I wish that we had his voice telling us what he thought was going on in his own recollection.
Did he tell you why he wouldn't talk to you?
We weren't able to get a clear answer from that. I can say that Secretary Rumsfeld generally turns down most interview requests on just about any topic. So it's somewhat true to form there. I agree it was an unfortunate omission. But I think you'll see he still looms very large in the book. Yeah. You have a lot of other accounts of him. And then a couple of people who worked very closely with and for him, such as Steve Cambone and Eric Edelman. Again, they're no substitute for hearing from Rumsfeld himself, but we certainly tried.
Well, and this, of course, is a case with the surge where, as I mentioned, Rumsfeld was not particularly enthusiastic. And when you have a situation where you're writing a history of a decision, the person who necessarily opposes the decision doesn't necessarily want to talk about it oftentimes. It's not a unique phenomenon in oral history that people like to talk about their successes. Not to say that this was a failure for Rumsfeld, but it's not one that he puts down as a personal achievement of his.
The other omission, of course, is General George Casey, who, again, had also, by and large, opposed the surge decision. He was, you know, our commander in theater at the time and also turned down multiple requests for interviews, which was unfortunate, but we understand. So,
why examine this decision rather than the decision to go to war in Iraq in the first place?
You know, I think this was the most difficult decision Bush faced in office. And I'm often questioned when I say that. How can that be? He went to war. I think the decision to go to war in 2003, while difficult, was easier in the sense that Bush expected to win. There really was no question that the Iraqis would defeat us on the field. He expected there to be, you know, a successful occupation and then a successful, stable government to occur. And if you think good things are going to happen, those are easier decisions to make, even ones of life and death. In this case, the surge, most of his advisors initially said this is a bad idea. Most of the advisors said that this is going to be a case where civil war is going to break out. The General Washington consensus among Republicans or Democrats was that perhaps it was time to get out of Iraq as quickly as possible. So the fact that President Bush made a decision where he genuinely did not know or have any confidence himself what the outcome would be, I think makes this a much more difficult decision than the initial decision to go to war.
I'll add something to that, too, and I agree with everything Jeff said there on why this was such a profoundly much more difficult decision is the political context. It's easy to forget now, but back in late 2002, early 2003, there was a pretty overwhelming bipartisan consensus in the country, both among public opinion and also Congress, to go to war in Iraq. That's why Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and Joe Biden all voted in favor of the war when they were in the Senate. You know, they all later repeated that. But at the time, it was not a terribly controversial decision for President Bush to make. Again, contrast that with 2006, 2007. It's not just that so many of his own top advisors were against it. The Republicans and the Democrats in Congress were overwhelmingly against it. Public opinion was overwhelmingly against it. All the different quotients of political capital that a president will look to or rely on were against President Bush, and yet he still made this decision. And that's what is so fascinating for us.
Something that comes up in this book is the idea that President George W. Bush was not the same person in 2006 than he had been back in 2003 when he ordered the initial invasion of Iraq. How had experience changed him as a leader?
I'll mention a few things there. And first, I'll say that this is not unique to President Bush. You look at any president, especially those who serve two terms, and there's this tremendous learning that takes place in office. No matter what you've done before, nothing can really prepare you for the profound demands of being president of the United States. And so every president is going to learn while they're in office. In President Bush's case, part of it was I think he learned to be a little more skeptical of the advice he was getting from his generals. You know, he again had great respect for them, but was much less deferential there. Part of it was he was also a little more skeptical of how quickly political opinion and how quickly conventional wisdom can change. And he saw some of the herd mentalities of groupthink that were going on in Washington, D.C. And in the political class there. Partly was by late 2006, early 2007, he feels like he's got a team that he can trust and work with a little bit more. Once you had Rice as Secretary of State, Hadley as National Security Advisor, Gates as Secretary of Defense, is a pretty unified team. Strong contrast with Rumsfeld and Powell and Cheney and a lot of the acrimony of the first the first term. So he felt like he had a better team, even if they disagreed with each other, as done with civility and cordiality. And then he trusted them to implement his decision more too.
Well, and I think it's also really important to note that the point that you just made, both of you, that President Bush was a different type of leader in the second term, that's not us saying it, and that's not you saying it. That's the people who are around him in their histories saying it. One of the things I love about this project is that we don't necessarily need to ask where your evidence is. The whole book is the evidence. Mm-hmm. It's the people around him say he was a different leader, which, to be honest, suggests if they're praising the leader in the second term that they think that perhaps they wish the leader of the second term in many cases what had been there in the first term. But as Will pointed out, no president gets to come into office with experience. It simply just doesn't happen.
Does he say that about himself?
Not so explicitly, but yeah, you see a number of signs of that, I think, in our interview with him. So, yeah. I want to say one more thing on the changes that President Bush experienced in office. And this comes out bits and pieces here in this book, but I saw it having worked for him on the National Security Council staff. He's a pretty avid reader of history. And amidst all the insane demands of the job, he was making time every night, every weekend to read history books. And by 2006, he'd read a lot more history books than he had when he had first become president. And he was especially fascinated by the challenges that wartime presidents had faced, Lincoln, FDR in particular. He also was fascinated by the Vietnam War history. Of course, he had lived through that and now was presiding over, you know, a looming new Vietnam in our history. And so he brought more of a historical consciousness to his decisions, you know, thinking about how will this look in light of history rather than just how is this going to look in tomorrow's opinion polls. So.
A lot of people who were in the room when this decision was being discussed were thinking about Vietnam.
Vietnam is omnipresent. You know, of course, now we are more than a decade removed from the decision to surge. So take a decade off and you realize that we have people in the room when President Bush is making this decision who had served in Vietnam. You know, the top generals had been young officers, and the general consensus among people who had served in Vietnam or who had been policymakers during Vietnam was not just that Vietnam was difficult for the experience, but that the army itself suffered for years after. The phrase that they used oftentimes was the army was broken. I've never quite been able to figure out what they mean by that, in the sense that, you know, yes, morale was down after Vietnam. Yes, drug use was up after Vietnam. But frankly, drug use was up in the 1970s as a general populace anyway. And so I think that what was really a concern for Bush and those around him was if we lose in Iraq, there will be a number of awful consequences, one of which will be hurting the armed forces for perhaps a generation to come, not just the soldiers on the ground.
Another thing that the president said was that the most important decision for him was, do I want to win this or not? Why would a president not want to win something?
Well, they're the costs, right? I mean, sure, we all say we want to win, but at that point, the Iraq War had been so much more costly in blood and treasure and in intangibles like credibility and political capital than he had ever anticipated, you know, when the original decision to go to war was made in 2003. And so even as he's looking at the possibility, is there any chance of winning here? You have to ask, at what cost? And I do want to pick up on one of the points Jeff made earlier about the—
Let me jump in because we have to take a quick break, and I want you to be able to get your full point in. My guests are Will Inboden and Jeffrey A. Engel, co-editors of The Last Card, Inside George W. Bush's Decision to Surge in Iraq. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about a new work of oral history collected in a book called The Last Card, Inside George W. Bush's Decision to Surge in Iraq. My guests are Jeffrey A. Engel, director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU, and Will Inboden, executive director and William Powers Jr. Chair at the Clements Center for National Security, also associate professor of public affairs at UT. Will, you were saying that you wanted to pick up on what Jeffrey had been saying about President Bush thinking about the military after Vietnam.
Yeah, and this comes out very vividly. The account is in our book when in December of 2006, President Bush travels over to the Pentagon to meet with the Joint Chiefs in what's called the tank, you know, the Joint Chiefs' big secure conference room. And the Joint Chiefs still had very legitimate concerns about the incredible strain on the military that these repeated deployments were doing. And that was one of the reasons why they wanted to reduce our presence in Iraq. And whereas they knew President Bush was thinking about sending another 30,000 troops there. And so the chiefs brought up the concern this could break the force, meaning we won't be able to get any more new troops coming in. We'll have so many leaving. We won't be an effective fighting force anymore. And the president responded that he was very mindful of that concern, but he had also seen post-Vietnam what had really broken the force was losing a war and how demoralizing that was for our military in the 70s and early 80s. And he had lived through that as a much younger person, and he didn't want to see that particular mistake of history made again. And he knew that having losing the war in Iraq would even be more demoralizing for the military for a generation. One other quick point I'll make too is on the human cost to this is every Friday afternoon the president would go out to Walter Reed to visit wounded troops recovering in the hospital there. And he was also regularly meeting with the parents of those who had been killed in action. And you hear, very emotionally gut-wrenching meetings, but he, felt the acute burden of seeing the human face of his decisions. And he would hear overwhelmingly from them, not everyone agreed, but overwhelmingly, make sure my son, my daughter, my husband did not die in vain or did not lose these limbs in vain. And so he also felt fairly acutely of keeping faith with the troops and doing everything he could to win so that they knew that these horrible sacrifices they'd endured had not been in a losing cause.
American leaders are the president, the cabinet, military leaders are duty-bound to think of American interests. How much did you hear from anyone that was interviewed for the book about concerns about the death toll among Iraqis?
Well, I think actually that's one of the driving forces for President Bush and those around him, that the idea that if the United States did just simply pull out at this point in 2005, 2006, as the situation is deteriorating, we would see a situation that would be not just a civil war, but a civil war of extermination in many ways. You know, many of the cities in Iraq had already in some ways been ethnically cleansed by one group or another. And this really was a sectarian religious fight that was occurring. So there had already been hundreds of thousands of deaths in Iraq, and that number could have been doubled or tripled. And President Bush, in one particular meeting, made this point explicit that he did not want to take, not so much didn't want to take responsibility, but that he had the responsibility to ensure that if there was some way to keep those 100,000 extra people alive, that was something that made the surge worthwhile.
And I'll add to that exactly on Jeff's point is our shorthand for the surge is an increase in troops, and it was that, another 30,000. But the really important shift wasn't more troops. It was a new strategy, and that strategy was predicated on protecting Iraqi civilians. That's why he knew that we were losing the war is so many – and that was one of the metrics that we were following is how many Iraqi civilians are being killed each week, each month. And if we can protect them and get those numbers way down, that will then give them a chance to start to engage in a political process of reconciliation and self-governance and so forth. But it was not until we could stop that awful body count among the innocent Iraqi civilians being killed that we could see that progress. And that was the strategic concept behind the surge.
Well, and let me just pick up on one point there to demonstrate that sentence that my colleague Will offered, that the United States was using a body count of civilians in many ways to gauge how much violence was occurring. It's actually not even as simple as that, because there was so much violence occurring and so much violence that was not in the open that demographers had to come in and statisticians had to come in to try to determine what exactly was the death count in Iraq. That is to say, we were able to track, let's say, 100,000 people, but demographers told us that, you know, there's another 100,000 that are missing, in a sense, and therefore we can presume that they are not there. And there actually was a very disturbing, interesting, fascinating, and disturbing debate that occurred among medical officials. How do we actually know what the body count is in this type of chaotic situation? And the thing you should take away from that is it was really bad.
How much did leaders – I mean, there had been progress on the political front. There were elections and people were very excited. And yet that progress failed to yield the results that a lot of Americans had hoped for in terms of peace and a kind of reunification. Should they have understood that it wouldn't be quite so simple?
The American people, you mean?
The American leaders.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I think that was certainly one of the many regrets, a lot of, President Bush and a lot of leaders in the administration had in hindsight is an overly optimistic belief about the possibility of political progress in Iraq. And this is, again, going back to the surge decision, is the governing strategic assumption up through 2006 had been, let's get political progress first, and then the Iraqis will learn to live peaceably with each other and security will improve. Our tagline for it, I'm speaking as a former Bush official here now, was ballots before bullets, right? Ballots, not bullets. If they learn to cast ballots, they'll resolve their differences that way rather than using bullets. And one of the fundamental shifts in the surge is flipping that strategic assumption and realizing, no, security needs to precede political progress. It's not until we can get the violence down, protect the population, that they can only then be in a better place to think about the possibility of elections and pluralism and some of the ingredients of a more peaceful society.
It's a really different thing, but it reminds me of the debate that has now leaned in one direction about housing people first before homeless people before trying to fix the other problems that they might have with mental illness and substance use and that sort of thing. It's really interesting to think about it writ large on that scale.
Yeah. It is.
Well, and I think my mother's listening, and so I'll say something that she always used to point out as a school teacher, that if you have hungry kids in your class, they're not going to learn. So make sure that everybody has their basic needs met, in this case in Iraq, the basic need of security, before you start to think about expansive ideas like political solidarity.
What did this project tell you about who was the author of the surge or the original thinker of an idea for something like the surge?
I'll start. And again, one of the fun things about doing these interviews and having all these transcripts is we'll let other scholars, other readers decide for themselves, right? I mean, because it is somewhat murky. That said, I came away even more convinced after this that the single unsung hero in all this is Megan O'Sullivan. And then I think Brett McGurk and Peter Fever among the NSC staff. And of course, Steve Hadley should all be singled out as the policy entrepreneurs, if you will, the ones on the NSC staff who surfaced these problems and who pushed forward to make sure the president was mindful of it and that a better idea was available.
And here's where I get to disagree.
Okay.
Not necessarily.
See, the two co-editors can disagree.
Yeah, and that's what made it so much fun is that, Will was in the administration. I was not in the administration. And so we took different perspectives in coming out the book as well as our co-authors, editors as well. I think Will is correct that the story that we have in the book directs credit for the surge to all the people that he just mentioned, and especially focused on the NSC. As a historian looking at this broadly, I'm not convinced that further discussion is going to bring out other authors and other actors. Clearly, the NSC is always going to play a part in the story, and clearly President Bush was listening in many ways to the NSC. But we don't have the full range of documentation yet. We don't have the full range of oral histories yet. The book that we have and the story that we have points in the direction of the NSC being the locus of change. But to be honest, I'm going to wait to see another 25 books come out before I make a conclusion.
So there are debates and discussions happening at the level of the White House. What was the Iraq study group commissioned by Congress talking about, and how much teeth did the Iraq study group's conclusions have teeth in terms of public policy?
So I'll offer my take on this, and then again, Jeff may have a different one. So fascinating backstory to Baker Hamilton, the Iraq study group named after the co-chairs, former Secretary of State James Baker and former Congressman Lee Hamilton. Congress had originally commissioned that. Frank Wolf was the main architect when he thought the Iraq war was actually going better than the media was reporting a couple years earlier. And so he had said, we need a commission of respected bipartisan American elders who can go over and see how things are going pretty well there and then come back and tell the American people it's going pretty well. Between the time when he passed that legislation and then the commission was formed, things had gone from bad to worse in Iraq, and the commission found itself then with this mandate to actually take a look at the situation and come up with some better ideas. And I will say again, having been on the NSC staff at the time, if you read the Baker-Hamilton report carefully, it has a lot of interesting ideas and diagnoses, but there's a number of internal contradictions there. It very much is written by committee and different voices there. And so the main thrust of it seemed to be saying, get out, pull out. You know, this is a lost cause. Instead, try to do a diplomatic grand bargain to disengage. But then there was a couple lines in there said, however, we would be open to a short-term surge in troops. Chuck Robb in particular, one of the commission members, was one of the ones who helped put that in there. And that created a little bit of political cover for some of the advocates within the administration to say, okay, maybe that's something we want to jump on, which they'd been thinking about already.
Well, again, this takes us back to the big picture that is going on at this time, that Iraq has gone from bad to worse, as you mentioned. And just think about the fact that President Bush has a congressionally mandated review, if you will, of his homework, of his work in Iraq and how well or poorly it's going. And by the way, it appears to be going more and more poorly. And that's a really interesting thing for a president to try to come up with solutions while someone else who is in the public eye is grading their work and also coming up with their own solutions with a different set of information, perhaps, because they don't have access to the same information the president does. It really reinforces that this had become the singular issue in Washington at the time and one that there was bipartisan agreement that Iraq was in trouble.
A surge could have been 10,000 troops. It could have been 75,000 troops. How did 30,000 troops become the number?
Again, part of it was looking at conditions on the ground and getting some recommendations from, for example, General Petraeus, who wasn't there, but was looking at it, General Keane, a few others in terms of would that be enough along with that new mission? Again, it's not just about the numbers of troops, the new mission of providing population security. So if we take the 160,000 we already have there and add another 30,000 and give them this new mission, would that be enough? Another part of it is that's about all with the extra troops we had. We did not, there's arguments to even have these additional 30,000. They were found, but we did not have another 75,000. So that was the outer limit of what could be allocated.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd.
Well, and again, this is where the complexity comes in on this situation, that was the amount of available combat-ready troops within the proper deployment cycle that could be cycled over to Iraq with extended service in Iraq to stay there. One of the points that several of our oral histories make is that this is a military. This is a military that is losing a war. If you need to, you can order every cook and every technician and every secretary in the military to grab a rifle and go. And so when President Bush was trying to figure out whether or not going in big or pulling out was the best way to save the force, there's also a sense in which we have to ask what kind of force would we save. We have a very specialized military at this point where there are remarkably few people who actually carry weapons in our Pentagon, in our military. You could change that dynamic, but it would not be the American military that we know today.
Condoleezza Rice made the point that, of course, the president has the authority to order the people working for him to do whatever he wants that is legal. And yet it was important to him to make the case to the people who would carry out these orders. How did he do that and why was it so important?
Yeah, this is one of the reasons for the timing of the surge and why the decision was drawn out a little more is that the president knew that even though he could order the generals to do this, he wanted them to have more buy-in. He wanted them to actually come around and agree with him on this. And so that's why he spent quite a bit of time making sure he was hearing them out, laying out his case for why he thought that this was the right decision, giving them a chance to air their dissenting views. And then particularly for the Army and Marines, committing to them that he would go to Congress and ask for an increase in their end strength. In other words, an increase in their number of personnel, saying, I know we're going to be sending 30,000 more over there, so I'm going to get even more for that because I know you Army and Marines are concerned about, are you going to have enough forces for your other missions? So there was also that very specific gift, if you will, that he was giving them.
We have an email here from Bob in Fort Worth, Texas, who writes, the intelligence about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, the president understood Bob understands there were no weapons found. What did that do to public opinion about war efforts and the decisions surrounding the surge?
Not surprisingly, it decreased enthusiasm for trusting the government and trusting the opinion of the president when he goes in front of the White House to say, here is the mandate that I offer. And it really reinforces that point that we were just discussing a moment ago of the president's role in our society, not as a dictator, not as a absolute ruler, but as a person who, frankly, is a politician even after elected. And if there's one thought to take from this as we read it in 2019, every book that we have, every document that we have, every history that we ever hear, we always understand it in the terms of the moment that we're engaging it. In 2019, the critical lesson that one can take from this book is that the President of the United States is a factor, a big one, but is a factor in making policy in the United States. It's not a dictatorship. And so President Bush was forced to get the generals on board, forced to get diplomats on board, because people, you don't want them just doing the policy because you're ordering them to. You want them to want to do the policy, to believe in the policy. You'll get a much better outcome for that. And by the way, you'll get a less likelihood of Congress coming in and pulling the rug out. That is to say, if a president comes in and does something completely out of line with what the military wants, 180 degrees, you can better believe that Senate and House telephones will start ringing.
Let me add one other thing on that, going back to the mistaken intelligence on Iraq not having weapons of mass destruction. That, of course, caused a huge loss of faith among the American people in the credibility of our government, as Jeff just said. But remember, it also caused President Bush to become a lot more skeptical of his intelligence community. He didn't feel deliberately misled by them, but he knew they were acting in good faith. But he was also very disappointed that the intelligence had been wrong. So fast forward to 2006 when he's deliberating over possible options on how to resolve this horrible mess in Iraq. He's a much more skeptical consumer of the intelligence assessments he's getting and the assessments he's getting from his military, just because he knew that they had been wrong, especially the intelligence community in 2003. So it also didn't just make the American people more skeptical, it made Bush himself more skeptical.
Well, and again, this is a great point for 2019, because I think the purpose of history is twofold. It's to study it because it's fascinating. It's the best reality TV show we have, but also to try to take something from it and to try to learn something from it. And it's very clear at this point that President Bush was trying desperately to find new sources of information, was trying to reach outside the normal channels, reach outside the Washington bubble, if you will. And we have to ask ourselves, when the president of the United States, any president, receives information from maybe only one or two sources, that can warp the perspective of even the best decision maker.
My guests are Jeffrey A. Engel and Will Inboden, editors of the new book, The Last Card, Inside George W. Bush's Decision to Surge in Iraq. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Will Inboden, Executive Director and William Powers Jr. Chair at the Clemens Center for National Security and Associate Professor of Public Affairs at UT, and Jeffrey A. Engel, Director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. The book that they edited together is called The Last Card, Inside George W. Bush's Decision to Surge in Iraq. I want to make sure that we all understand why there were strong objections to the idea of a surge from people who were quite well informed, who understood the region as well as any American did at the time. What was the sort of worst case scenario envisioned by the people who either initially or on an ongoing basis felt as if a troop surge and a change in counterinsurgency strategy might be a mistake?
I think I'd point to two related ones. One, that it was just going to be more ghastly losses of American troops, more diminished public trust, more erosion of our institutions. And then related to that, more bloodbath in Iraq itself, more dead Iraqi civilians, and Iraq's continued fracturing into a failed state and civil war. Everything was bad was just going to get so much worse. So,
yeah. All right, let's go to the phones. Michael is on the line in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Michael.
Oh, yes. It's well known among the American people that all the wars, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, were dismal failures and have made all those places worse. To what extent do you think moderate Democrats and centrist Democrats handed Trump the election by not having any principle and by supporting those wars?
It's a little bit off topic, but maybe we can talk a little bit about there were a lot of people objecting to an expansion of the Iraq war, even from, as the surge was happening. A lot of Americans you know, said we needed to be out of there. The president maybe arguably successfully didn't make the case as well to the American public as he did to his own advisors.
Well, and let's also remember, the historical context. We are only 3 years, 4 years removed from 9/11. So telling the American people that their security and their interests are intertwined, like it or not, with events in the Middle East and events around the world and in the prevention of failed states is not a hard argument in the least in that, because the memory was so clear and so searing. And so I think one of the things that's interesting about President Trump's decision to, of late, rail against the endless wars in the Middle East is that what he's really railing against is not just the Middle East, but against American engagement overseas. That American presidents from 1945, President Bush included, have made the argument that it is expensive and costly to help police the world, but that's a heck of a lot less money and certainly less blood and treasure than it would be to let the world run amok.
Since you wanted to engage with this, Jeffrey, you wrote a few months ago that President Trump misses the presidency's entire point as the founders conceived of it. So tell us about that.
Okay. Wasn't expecting that. So we have to remember, when the founders conceived of the presidency, they had one man in mind, and that was George Washington. And George Washington's primary virtue in their minds was not that he was the smartest guy, not that he was the most courageous, not that he was the best leader. He certainly wasn't the best talker. It was that everyone trusted him to put the country first. He had made on numerous occasions, decisions that essentially allowed his own personal fortunes to suffer for the sake of the country. And therefore, the founders thought that a person should take such pride and such responsibility of being in office, any office, but the presidency in particular, that they would be willing to sacrifice everything that they had for the common people. President Trump, in my opinion, has not exemplified that Washingtonian spirit. And I would point, interestingly enough, to a discussion that occurred a few months ago when the president at first denied that he had been trying to work on a tower in Moscow during the election, and then came out and said, well, yes, I was, but what's the big deal? Why should I lose money just because I'm going into office? The founders would have immediately said, this person is not qualified. This person does not have the right disposition. The fact that you would even ask yourself, do I care about whether or not I would personally suffer for the honor and the privilege of serving the entire population? If you ask that question, someone else should do the job.
A lot of people are trying to understand the decision-making process in the Trump White House based on media accounts, which are typically fed by leaks from within the administration. As historians, and historians who have asked people after the fact, who no longer have much of a reason to dissemble or try and shade the truth, how accurate are reports that leak from a White House in turmoil?
I think it's hard to make a generalization there, but overall, they're probably fairly accurate. Thinking back to some of the internal chaos within the Reagan administration, I mentioned this because I'm working on a book on this right now. You know, a lot of the journalistic accounts at the time were pointing out the internal chaos, and as we now have the documents and the oral histories and all that, yeah, it was pretty chaotic. I should say I still think President Reagan got a lot of big policies right, but in contemporary moment, I have a number of friends and acquaintances who've served in the Trump administration who are no longer there, and the consistent line I hear from them is as bad as it sounds when you read about it in the papers. It's even worse on the inside. So,
I just finished a book on an earlier period, on the 1980s and 1990s, and I became a very boring person when people would ask me what surprised you in the archive, what'd you find that really shocked you, and I said nothing, because there are 5,000 journalists working every day in Washington to figure out what's going on, and they're really good. And so consequently, we get a lot more detail, we get a lot more nuance from the documents, we get a lot more of the substance. But the general storyline, I think, is pretty well known as it's happening.
What's the difference between a journalistic interview and an oral history interview?
So a journalist, I think, is trying to tell their own story. And they are trying to find information in order to make sense of disparate inputs of evidence in order to tell the reader their assessment. This, of course, is why there is, I think, an unfair criticism of journalists these days, that there is inherently bias, because, of course, there's inherently bias. They are trying to tell a story as they see it. An oral history is opening up the mic and saying, tell us what you think. Tell us what you remember. In fact, we had to basically convince every single person that we talked to that it was in their best interest or in their interest or not going to be detrimental to their interest to sit down for one of these interviews, because public officials, presidents of the United States, are naturally skeptical of anybody that comes and wants to put a microphone in their face and then perhaps ask questions that are just designed to embarrass. This is the exact opposite process. Our goal was to let people tell the story that they want to tell. And we asked, I think, tough questions in order to say, what will future generations want to know? What will future historians and future students ask? What should the American people understand better? Not necessarily, why did you make a mistake, but explain to me why you came to that conclusion. And I think those are two fundamentally different questions.
Fully agree with Jeff. One other thing to add, time. Journalists are usually asking people, what are you thinking about right now? What did you do yesterday? Oral histories, it's usually saying, you know, 5, 10, 15 years have passed. Please reflect back now in that open-ended way on what you saw then, what you thought then, and maybe what you've learned since.
Exactly. In fact, I say whenever you're reading an oral history or doing an oral history, and, you know, the average example of this is that these interviews would take 3-4 hours sometimes, and you might get in this book perhaps 3 paragraphs from that. Now, again, as I said, you can go online and see the entire thing. But I point out, whenever you're talking to someone and they say, you know what really mattered? That means that what's going to come next is really the gold nugget because they've thought about it and they've put all the pieces together and that's their conclusion. The rest of it might be interesting detail. When someone says what really matters is, that's when you should listen.
What do you do in an oral history when someone states something as fact that is either deliberately or simply in error and contradicts something that you've heard from someone else?
In my case, we pointed out. My team, I should say, we try to point it out, and we try to point it out gently because we want the oral history to continue. But we do again say, this is your story. So if you were to offer me something which I would know to be factually incorrect, I might say something along the lines of, really, that's really interesting because that runs against the general consensus that suggests this. Or, you know what? That's really interesting because that is directly opposite of the information that was published and available at the time. Explain why you think your opinion is different than why your opinion is right. That's different from everyone else's. So again, giving people the opportunity to explain themselves in their own words, even as you're saying, I'm not going to take this without asking questions beyond the initial question. Let people tell their own story.
Exactly. And I'll just say sometimes the why that they get a fact or recollection wrong can be really interesting in and of itself, and finding out how and why did they come to that misremembrance or misunderstanding. So that's why the follow-up questions that Jeff mentioned are really helpful. That said, I'll say from the interviews in this I participated in, I was overall struck by the relative accuracy of most of the things. This was such a vivid searing time that people went through. They still had a pretty good hold on a lot of it. The differences are really on what it meant and who was right and who was wrong and things like that. And that's where some really interesting texture comes out.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm also curious about what a project like this that's happening about a relatively contemporary subject with people who are still alive and able to be, you know, called back if you've got a secondary question, about history drawn from the papers and letters of people who have been dead for centuries, people who may have poured their very souls out onto a piece of paper and may, in fact, have had ulterior motives, manipulative purposes in the words they chose and the way they chose to represent things. Is there something that contemporary oral history can teach us about how to read old source documents?
Yes, it's exactly what you just pointed out, that we must read every document skeptically. I think here's a place where historians and journalists are alike in that we want to have multiple confirmed sources for any particular point. You know, I have to say, I run an oral history project. And I will tell you, I am extraordinarily skeptical of oral history for the simple reason that people have terrible memories. If I ask you what you had for lunch today, it's most likely you're going to get it wrong. Now ask you something that happened 20 years ago, that also details are probably going to be wrong. But it's the thought process that people put into, as I said before, the question of what really mattered to them and what really matters to them at the time is extraordinarily revealing and can help us shine light on documents that may have been written in order to manipulate at one time. The truth is, every document has its own vantage point, and this is another way for people to tell us which documents are really, really important. If we can get confirmation of evidence, that's the best. But ultimately, we have to remember that people are both terrible at remembering things and also have interesting things to say.
Let me just add quickly, I think a lot of the real value of this oral history project we did here will be revealed 15 to 25 years from now when the documents are declassified, because most of them are still classified. We don't have the documented record now, but when people can read those 25 years from now alongside these transcripts we've produced, that will be interesting.
Are there people who are just easier to work with in these situations than others? Are there some nuts that are just tough to crack, even for people who say, I'm coming to you for a neutral, true account of what happened?
You know, in my experience, one should avoid lawyers. People who are trained in law as oral histories usually give terrible oral histories because they are trained to give short, concise answers. I'll give you one example. I had an interview with Secretary of State Baker at one time and went in with 3 pages of questions and ran out. Because if I asked him, what was your opinion on Mikhail Gorbachev, he said, I don't recall. I don't have a recollection. You have to ask someone else. And if you get 3-line answers from people, that can be a very boring oral history. So again, this is why we want to make sure that people are comfortable with the process and comfortable knowing that their words are not going to be manipulated. This is one of the key reasons, and this is actually one of the real, I think, innovations of our entire oral history project. One of the key reasons why we insist on, in almost every case, on videotaping things, because that's much harder for someone to say my words were manipulated when the videotape is right there and when their facial expressions are right there as well. I want people to be able to tell their story and not worry that it's going to be misconstrued because it's their words.
We also all share the human tendency to make meaning of things that happen in our lives, decisions we made after the fact. Sometimes these things were not at all in our minds, but as time passes, we come to a different conclusion. Is that a risk or a benefit of oral history?
I think it's both. And then again, I go back to my earlier point of how we really need to read these oral history transcripts alongside the archival documents once they're declassified, the contemporaneous ones, and then just map that out. And I think they'll help illuminate each other in some ways. It may create some new puzzles as well. But even where you see some of the oral histories differing from what the archives show, that in and of itself may be an interesting story. And how and why did that person change their account or remember it differently than the documents?
But we really shouldn't be surprised if people change their opinion. We change our opinion on things all the time as new events unfold. You know, I like to say that a peace treaty that lasts 20 years is considered a brilliant piece of diplomacy right up until the moment that war breaks out, at which point people look back and say, oh, that was such a mistaken idea of that treaty, forgetting the 20 years in between. We all are constantly reassessing, and that's one of the things that makes history so much exciting for us, is that we are in a constant process of negotiating how we recall the past in terms of how we have to live in the present with its consequences.
Jeffrey A. Engel is director of the Center for Presidential History at SMU. Will Inboden is executive director, and William Power, senior chair at the Clements Center for National Security and associate professor of public affairs at UT. Together with Timothy Andrew Sale and Hal Brands, they are editors of the new book, The Last Card, Inside George W. Bush's Decision to Surge in Iraq. Will and Jeffrey, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Appreciate Thank you, Chris.
It.
You can subscribe to our podcast using your favorite podcast app. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.